Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. On The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about the future. We articulate an unusual view of the future. And we tell the straight scoop about the future, which is that our world isn't necessarily going to hell in a handbasket or by any other means, but that, in fact, it's getting better all the time. And not only that, but that we stand on the brink of an incredibly bright future. And if we play our cards right, it's going to be a future that most of us haven't even imagined or even dared hope for. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio, as always, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic. How are you doing?
Man, I'm excellent. Yeah, had a good weekend. Took the kids to a movie, and it's been one of those lazy ones, and that's kind of nice every now and then.
That's good. Well, before the program started, I was just complaining about I think I overdid it on the yard work this weekend myself. So I think more movies, less yard work would have been a good thing.
Well, if you doze off into a, you know, you start taking a snooze in the middle of the program, I guess I'll fill in. But
speak loudly. No, just, you know, shout or something like that. That'll get me right back on. We've also got Michael Darling on the line. Hey, Michael.
Good evening.
Mr. Chat Host, how are you?
I'm living the short dream, the nap dream.
Okay, well, Stephen, I guess, is going to be our awake guy for the evening for sure. So, you said that you went to a movie, took the kids to a movie. Let's hear about it.
Well, I went to the new Narnia movie. That's the Prince Caspian.
Prince Caspian, yes.
Yeah, it's a follow-up to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. This is Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian. And I thought it was a very good movie. I found it more exciting and more interesting movie, really, than the original. And that's unusual for sequels. You know, usually the sequel's a bit of a letdown. This was good. I thought it was. I thought the battle scenes were there was a couple of ingenious plot devices. Something I'd never seen done, or even suggested in a battle before, took place in this battle. And I don't want to give it away. It's too big of a spoiler, but take it from me, it's a battle you'll want to see.
Okay, well, I got to see that movie last week. I enjoyed it very much too. Actually, I liked it more than I liked. We were talking last week about the new Indiana Jones film. And I think a lot of this has to do with expectation. I was expecting great things from Indiana Jones. Got a pretty good movie, so. You know, that wasn't quite there for me. I was not expecting all that much from Prince Caspian. I didn't think it was going to be that great. And I'll tell you why is because that was always, I thought, maybe the slowest book in the whole Narnia series. To me, it always felt like it was mostly set up, and you get to Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and then some of those later books. The pace is a lot better, and the story flows along a lot better. So I was really impressed with how they translated that movie onto the screen and made it, made it a really compelling story. It made me want to go back and read the book and maybe appreciate it a little more than I did last time I read it. So,
I've got the book on my shelf. It's an all-inclusive volume that has all the stories in it, and I need to go through it again. I haven't read it.
Now, are they in the correct? The correct order, or the chronological order?
They are in chronological order, meaning that the last book published is the first book in the volume.
Oh, okay, okay.
Because the last book published was Magician's Nephew was the last book that C.S. Lewis published in the Narnia series, but chronologically it was first.
It tells the beginning of Narnia, so. Now they publish the books in that order, but they're making the movies in the order that he published the books, which I think is To me, that's the correct order, because that's the order I read them in.
I'm not sure how that they would translate The Magician's Nephew. That would be a difficult one. There are some things about that.
I would have thought that any of these movies books would have been tough to make to make movies out of. They've definitely followed some of the Lord of the Rings just in terms of the scope and the scale of them. You know, when I read those books, I never pictured things being as big and grand as they are in these movies. But they're very true to the characters. And I think one of the reviews I read, they said, was they really got Aslan right this time. You know, he showed up just about as much as he needed to, and the things he said were the things you wanted him to say. You know, he was playing the role that that you would want him to play. But not everyone agrees with that. I read the on the official Roger Ebert website, a review by a guy named Jim Emerson, and he had two major complaints with Prince Caspian. One of them was, he said, the problem with the Narnia stories is that they all, by definition, are going to have this Deus ex machina ending, where, you know, quite literally God steps in and saves the day at the end. And he said, so how can you have any real dramatic tension when you always know that's going to happen? And
I thought that's why I like this movie better. You know, in the first movie, I mean, it was quite literally all Aslan. You know, I mean, the kids were really too young to be believable warriors, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so Aslan, when he saves the day, he really saved the day. But in this movie, he kind of showed up at the end, and a little bit. But I mean, it's the kids are more believable. The actors they got playing these roles are more believable as warriors, and they came across well, and. And the lion didn't steal the thunder, you know.
He didn't steal the show from him, that's for sure. Although, to me, I just think that argument is a little silly. For one thing, Aslan always follows the rules in Narnia, so that even in the first movie, he's subject to deep magic from before the beginning of time. And in this movie, he says, "Well, I can't do things twice the same way," and I won't say more than that. But things could have worked one way, or they could have worked another way, but. He's not a guaranteed show there at the end, except for the fact that you know it's going to have a happy ending, and that's the part that that got me wondering about this Jim Emerson. I mean, do you suppose he goes into a Spider-Man movie and sits down and goes, "Now this film has dramatic integrity because Peter Parker could really die, and this could really be the end of all Spider-Man," right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
It's like you know it's going to work.
Ditto
out,
James
right?
Bond, or you know,
yeah,
yeah. You know.
Yeah, exactly. To me,
Indiana Jones. You know, if you've seen the Indiana Jones Chronicles, you know that he lives to be 102 years old. So
right. Yeah. It's going to work out.
Yeah. So go ahead.
But here's the other part. Here's the other part from the review. This is the part that got my attention. Okay, and I'm going to read this quote. He says, "The larger question remains: why really do the Narnians need some anti-democratic, monarchy-loving European son of Adam to lead them, to protect them, to fulfill their prophecies? There's an obvious candidate for the job here, a towering black centaur named Glenstorm, Cornell St. John, possessed of a noble bearing unsurpassed in Narnia." So first, let me just say that I thought Glenstorm was extremely cool. All right, so not to take anything away from him or any of the centaurs. I thought the centaurs really rocked, and the minotaurs were looking pretty good in the movie too. But
one of the most heroic acts in the movie was done by a minotaur.
Without spoiling it, but yes.
Yeah, it was very cool, and you just need to see the movie. So,
but you know, I love this whole anti-democratic, you know, bringing the Europeans in to rule over the Narnians. Okay, I just, one thing I need to point out is I don't care if he's black or if a black actor played him, okay? A centaur is as European as any white guy, right? I mean,
yeah.
Right?
That's where they were invented, yeah. Exactly.
You know, one, don't give me that. But the other part is he starts going down this path about, you know, trying to do this sort of, what do you call that literary criticism where they tear things apart? I can't think of the word for it, but making this political case about Prince Caspian. And what cracks me up is you start going all PC on the Narnia universe. I'm like, dude, you're one book early, okay? Wait till book three, and Eustace will show up and say all the things you're worried about, right? Because that kid comes in and he gives this completely PC critique of Narnia when he arrives, right? Right down to the fact that he can't stand Reepicheep because he thinks talking animals are sentimental, right?
Yeah.
So, I just the idea that he's laying something new on Narnia by criticizing it from that standpoint, I think is kind of funny. Anyway, I think it's a review that Eustace would have enjoyed very much.
Well,
I look forward to that third movie.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis was a very smart guy, and there's not too many aspects of his world that he didn't think about at some point and deal with. So yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah, I, you know, the thing is, if they don't need a son of Adam or a daughter of Eve to come and be king or queen in Narnia, you lose the whole idea of, you know, regular English kids get to go be kings and queens in Narnia. That's the whole fairy tale story, for crying out loud. I don't really think there was, there was any deep political, subversive, racist thing going on there. That was just the story he wanted to tell. So, anyway, that was my...
He was telling a story for kids in, you know, basically in the neighborhood, and that was
right.
British kids of that era, yeah.
But moving quickly on from Narnia, I've now made us spend more time on this than I thought, because the other thing we wanted to get to was to note a few, unfortunately, celebrity deaths that have occurred in the past week to week and a half. There's this saying that celebrity deaths occur in threes, or it seems to me that you notice them in threes. And I'd heard, I guess about a week ago, that, or maybe just a few days ago, that Sidney Pollack had died. And
yeah.
I'm sure everyone's familiar with, you know, brilliant actor and director, and seemed like a really good guy too, Sidney Pollack. So we were sorry to hear that he had passed. And then Harvey Korman, who guys my age, maybe and a little older, will remember as a comedian on the Carol Burnett Show, but who's probably best remembered for his role as role in Blazing Saddles as Hedy Lamarr.
That's Hedley.
That was a little slow, but we'll take it. We didn't have an MP3. Actually, you gotta be a little more nasal on that. That's Hedley. Like that.
Okay.
I have to play both parts. But anyway, very very sorry to hear about both Sidney Pollack and Harvey Korman. And then there was a third celebrity death to round it out. And, Stephen, you got the scoop on that one.
Well, it's a name you're not going to recognize, more than likely.
I think Fast Forward Radio listeners might.
Might. There's a chance, as a Fast Forward Radio listener, that you'll know this. This one has some geek cred. Alexander Courage is the man's name. He passed away this week. He was a composer for... the TV show themes and some movie themes, and there's one particular theme that he will forever be known for, and I'm going to play it.
All right.
Obviously, the Star Trek opening theme, and also the closing themes, and most of the themes throughout the entire running of the show. Of course, the opening theme is the one that got reworked a jillion times in all the movies and in most of the television series that have followed the original series have employed that theme in some way at some point. And so, anyway, that's Alexander Courage, and he gave us some music that's. I think iconic, if music can be iconic.
It is absolutely iconic. I couldn't agree more. So,
yeah.
Rest in peace, Alexander Courage. Thank you for your contribution to our world. That's a significant little piece of music there. You hear that and you go, boy, that really takes me back in a lot of different ways. That music has had a certain amount of influence on me, and that kind of takes us to our main topic of the evening. We're going to be talking tonight about what I call the Speculist Essentials. And these are the key influences, the things that have most influenced us in developing what is a pretty unique or at least very unusual outlook that we have on the future. So I thought it would be fun to break this down into a few categories and talk and see if we could talk through the list. And as we were talking about this morning, Stephen, it occurred to us that really there would be no time to do any more than each of us to contribute one in each of these categories if we were going to try to make it fit into a regular show.
Right. It's just, you know, we could spend a whole show on any one of these categories
any one of them, absolutely.
If we didn't exercise a little discipline.
Yeah, and or try. You know, we always try. The categories that I listed were a person, an event, a website, a nonfiction book, a fiction book, and a movie or a TV show. So we're going to work through that list, I think, in reverse order, and we'll end with who is the person who has been the biggest influence on each of us as speculists. As we go through the list, Michael, if our listeners also have some contributions to the list, we'd like to hear about those.
Fair enough, and I'll feel free to make stuff up.
Okay.
Yeah, do, you know, clearly, because
contribute, however, yeah.
So anything you say, we're going to believe. And also, if you'd like to call us and share your items on the Speculist Essentials list, our phone lines are open. You can call us at 347-215-8972. So let's start with the movie or TV show that you have found most influential in shaping your thinking. And Stephen, I'll let you kick this off.
Well, a while back I did a sci-fi movie countdown that I put on the Speculist. It was, you know, basically my list of, you know, what are the best science fiction movies of all time. Number one, and at the top of that list, was Blade Runner. I still think it's the finest science fiction movie, but I'm not going to say that it's the one that's been most influential on me as a speculist. The reason being, it has some meat to it. Blade Runner does, but I think it's it makes number one really for artistic reasons. It's just a beautiful thing to behold, Blade Runner. But the movie, and you might find this a little strange, but the movie that I'm going to go with is Gattaca.
Okay, and Gattaca.
And it's not a perfect movie. It's not a perfect movie. There's some problems with it. It's kind of a strange combination of a sanitized dystopian future, which I think is, you know, the future is not going to be that sanitary, and it's not going to be that dystopian either. But it raises a issue that I think is going to be the primary issue for the coming century, and that is, how, you know, what will be the fate of normal humans in a world where there are beings that are superior both mentally and physically? And Gattaca suggests that it's not going to be an easy transition for normal humans.
In Gattaca, the world kind of belongs to those people, and people who have not had that kind of modification made are sort of outsiders, or they're a lower class. I mean, it's like a real class system is set in.
That's right. And it's, you know, basically the only job that a normal human is thought to be good enough for is, you know, just very menial labor types of things. And if you have a dream to do a different kind of work, something other than that, then, you know, you basically have to pass yourself off in some way as one of these super beings. And it's a good story. I enjoyed it. Again, I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I, as far as one that raises the issues that I think about probably a lot when I'm writing at the Speculist, that's a big one.
It absolutely does raise those issues. And, you know, the dramatic tension in the movie is around someone who's not part of that class struggling to be a meaningful part of the world anyway. Obviously, we hope for a future where people will be free to improve themselves, and there won't be these kinds of class limits where if someone has not you know, won the genetic lottery, there would be other means of doing it. But as far as raising those issues and also just being a really I think compelling movie, I think Gattaca is a great choice. Now my
choice. Yeah.
This is going to be weird because I could not decide. I ended up almost completely punting on movie or TV show because I was thinking, well, Star Trek or Blade Runner was actually in the running, as was The Matrix, as a matter of fact. But I've ended on one that's going to sound like I've lost it. Okay. I think the movie that is most influential to me as a speculist is Field of Dreams.
Okay, explain why. I love that movie. I love that movie, but I don't see it. What do you see there?
I never made a speculist connection with it until the most recent time I watched it. They were showing it on TBS. It was right before the beginning of baseball season. They were showing all these baseball movies, and Field of Dreams came on, and I watched it through. And it's always always been a very moving picture. Anyway, I mean, it's a story that really gets you. You know, if you're sentimental at all, and you like
baseball. if you don't cry at the end when he asks his dad, do you want to throw? You know, you want to play catch? I mean, there's something wrong with you. I mean,
if that doesn't get you,
you got no heart at all.
And the question that occurred to me the most recent time I was watching it was one that my dad had asked after he and I had watched it together the first time. Was he said, well, what's going on here in this movie? I mean, is it like a Twilight Zone episode? How is all this happening? And I started thinking, yeah, how is all this happening? And, of course, there's no religious or spiritual explanation given for how all this is happening. And for those who've never seen the movie, what's happening is that people are basically coming back from the dead and getting to play baseball again. It's one of those movies you can't explain it and make it sound anything other than like completely nuts, but it's this great story.
Fortunately, everybody's seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody's seen it. Great story about a guy builds a baseball field, and players who lost the ability to play, who never quite made it, who never really had their chance or had their chance taken away from them, get to come back and play baseball again. And I started thinking about the literary genre that the book occupied, and of course that is magical realism. And I started thinking about our favorite Arthur C. Clarke quote, which is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And though I don't think that Field of Dreams is a story about a post-singularity reality, I think that it shows the kind of transcendent things that could happen past the singularity. We talk about, you know, things that shatter our categories and that would seem to be beyond, you know, human ability or into the, you know, almost magical or miraculous or divine. I think those kinds of things you go, well, it would be great if that could happen, but there's no way it could happen. But I think things that we say that about, things that we say, well, it would be great if it could happen, but there's no way it could happen, those are the very things that might very well happen in a post-singularity world. So to me, Field of Dreams is a good picture of some of the stuff that might be possible in a way in a post-singularity world.
Yeah, it could just be a failure of our imagination to know how something like that might be possible. Yeah. Okay.
It appears to be it's time travel, or you know, are they souls? Are they simulations? I mean, once you start thinking about it, there, you know, if you try to give explanations for what's happening in Field of Dreams, there's just none offered up.
I love that line at the end where one of the players, it might have been his dad. I forget which of the players asked, "Is this heaven?" He says, "No, it's Iowa."
It's
I could have sworn
Iowa,
it was
yeah.
heaven. I could have sworn yeah. it was heaven. I thought for a while that Iowa should adopt that as their state motto. I could have sworn it was heaven.
I believe they have had tourist campaigns built around that line, actually.
Yeah.
So it wasn't completely lost on them. In fact, I believe that baseball field is still a place you can go look at. That to
awesome.
A certain extent, what is shown happening at the end of the movie really happened in real life. But we'll move on because we've got several of these to hit. And, Michael, anything in the chat room, or do you want to share your favorite movie or TV show?
Let me summarize quickly. It seems like everyone's focused on movies and not so much TV, although the obvious Star Trek question is, well, do you mean movie or TV? And if you mean TV, which version? So let me just say Star Trek gets mentioned. For movies, mentioned in the chat room, you have two that I was a little surprised by, more surprised than Field of Dreams, actually, and they are Network and Soylent Green.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then also referenced or mentioned Blade Runner and 2001. On my own list, I would say that as a visual cinematic experience, Blade Runner. because it was the first, I think it was the first thing I saw where visually I just came out of the movie going, okay, what the heck was going on? And, okay, they have flying cars, they have all this other stuff, it's raining all the time, it's this, it's that. I mean, there's a scene in Back to the Future where they, you know, he knows exactly when the rain's going to start and exactly when it's going to stop, and that was cool too. But I think that was after the Blade Runner moment.
Right.
Although, as a story, 2001: A Space Odyssey, I thought was more, you know, mind-boggling in the sense of, you know, Blade Runner. Okay, you've got replicants and you've got Blade Runners and who's who, and you got the little guy with the origami deal, and it was cool. But conceptually, I thought 2001 was bigger.
Since y'all
mentioned
really
Soylent Green, I'm sorry, I've got to play this.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, do it.
Please.
You got to tell them Soylent Green is people!
A little shout out to whoever picked Soylent Green as their most influential movie. We love getting in a good Charlton Heston quote anytime we can, anyhow. So, beautiful. All right, let's move on. We've got a lot of these to cover. And, Michael, for future reference, it's one, okay? You slipped two in on us. Don't try that again, pal. That's not going to cut it. Okay.
I was summarizing the chat.
Oh, I thought when you got to Blade Runner in 2001, you were giving your own name.
Yeah, okay, I did. You're right.
Yeah.
But I didn't
go
with the
chop
show.
Too bad.
I just stuck with...
But 2001 is a great choice, by the way. That was
a good choice.
Singularity before they were even talking about the singularity. That's what 2001's dealing with. So,
Arthur C. Clarke was talking about the singularity before anybody else because he was using that phrase about a sufficiently advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic.
Absolutely.
You know, he was all over it. Okay, let's move on to fiction or novel, I guess, is probably the correct way of putting that. I'll start this time, and I wanted to say the collected works of Greg Egan. And I wanted to list them all as one book and try to get away with it that way, but I decided, no, I have to narrow it down even further than that. So I'm going to say Permutation City by Greg Egan. If you've not read any of his books and you need to start somewhere, start with Permutation City. They're all great. They all bend your brain in a significant way. But Permutation City is just wacky, okay? It deals with a lot of the issues that we've talked about on this program copying consciousness and you know, the nature of identity. Actually, it gets into the nature of time. It gets into the big question as to whether a sufficiently advanced simulation is in any way actually different from the original thing itself. It poses this question about whether an algorithm is all you really need to create a universe, and maybe that algorithm doesn't even need to be running on anything necessarily. It's just it's a mind-bending, mind-blowing book. You notice I'm not even talking about the plot. I don't remember the plot. What I remember is all of these ideas that jump out of the book, and that would be my recommendation.
Well, that's interesting because my book is exactly the same. It's not that the plot really stuck with me. But one of the ideas that comes out in the book is like seared, you know. I'm thinking of singularity-aware novels. Rainbow's End is a great one that's come out recently. Vernor Vinge. Vernor Vinge? Vernor Vinge.
Yep.
I'm gonna go. Okay. It's Vernor Vinge. It's Vernor Vinge. I believe that's right. Anyway, Rainbow's End came out, and, of course, he is the guy that invented the term singularity to describe the technological singularity. He's the one who came up with it. And so, of course, his book should be Singularity Aware. Rainbow's End is about that period of time just prior to the singularity, and it's a good book. I think also of Crystal Rain, our friend Tobias Buckow. That book dealt with a civilization that had been transplanted by a post-singularity civilization onto a planet, and they basically had regressed somehow, and they had a pre-singularity civilization on this planet far away from Earth.
Right.
And I thought that was a neat device by which to deal with singularity issues without having to write post-singularity characters, which is next to impossible to do for a novelist. But
well, that's a good point. I mean, to write it for us to read, it's still going to have something recognizable, something that we can get our heads around if we're going to make any sense of the story at all.
That's right. That's right. But the one that wins it for me is Fire Upon the Deep, which is also a Werner Vinge novel. And in that book, the plot escapes me, but he invented an alien wolf pack race. And the individuals are as primitive as, like, wolves on this planet, but you put them together, and they form a hive mind consciousness. And the individuals that make up the pack, they don't call themselves individuals. When they get together, they're a single individual, and they might have the name Fang, three-toed claw, where, you know, one wolf is Fang, one is three-toed, one's claw, but they go together as one mind. It was so well done that, it's just an absolutely incredible creation. He did it in that book, and it won all kinds of awards that year too. So it's a well thought of book. I would recommend A Fire Upon the Deep.
Yeah, you hear about that one all the time. I think that's an excellent choice. So the answers from us so far are Permutation City and Fire Upon the Deep. By the way, Stephen, it seemed like you went through quite a few there too. So
yeah, I did. I'm sorry. I had to work through some to get to my one choice. I had one choice though.
It's a 60-minute program. Okay, what do we got in the chat room there?
In the chat room, we've got Neuromancer, which I have to confess I haven't read. I've gotten the Cliff Notes version by Osmosis, but I've never read it.
It's a great novel.
And Dostoevsky's The Idiot, which points to Harvey. I think that's a hell of a choice.
That is an excellent choice. That is a book that will bend your brain in a lot of different ways too. Absolutely.
Neuromancer invented a whole subgenre of science fiction. It was the first, I believe, cyberpunk novel. It's accepted as the first, I believe, and a really good book.
Whereas Dostoevsky invented modern fiction, pretty much. So
yeah.
There you go, and then. On my own list, I don't think I was thinking quite as deeply as Harvey, but I'm going to name one, although I picked multiple examples, but I'll just say Tom Sawyer. And my thinking is this, that, I mean, I read it early, and it had a huge impact on me, but as a speculist, the impact was that in reading novels, fiction, primarily 19th century or even earlier stuff, although Tom Sawyer was the first and probably the most powerful thing I read as a kid that was older, you just see how different things were then and now, and you start to draw that contrast, and it sort of, you know, begs the question, well, if that was Tom Sawyer's life in that era and here's my life in the latter part of the 60s or early 70s, you know, what's 100 years hence going to be?
Good point, yeah.
Absolutely, that's an excellent point, yeah, and Tom Sawyer, they're taking their log rafts made out of logs tied together down the Mississippi River, and
I think that was primarily the Huck Finn novel. Yeah.
You get the
lifestyle. You get a sense of what's going on in the community. You get a sense of, you know, obviously there's no cars, but there's and there's no electricity. There's no indoor plumbing, and you know stuff a 10-year-old can easily go, yeah, I have all this stuff. He didn't have all that.
Interesting point, yeah.
I think it's great that we got a Samuel Clemens and a Dostoevsky novel in our chat room contribution.
It speaks well for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. What a bright bunch.
Yeah.
Listening to our program. Hey, and speaking of our program, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working through the Speculist Essentials. If you'd like to chat with us about it, join the chat in the chat room or give us a call, 347-215-8972. Okay, let's move quickly on to nonfiction book. And, Stephen, I'll let you start.
I'm afraid we're probably going to have the same one for this,
okay.
Phil. The singularity is near.
I'm not going to have the same one.
Okay, good. Before that book was published, I would have had to have said The Age of Spiritual Machines. Which in many ways was very, very similar to Kurzweil's follow-up. When it comes to explaining why the world is developing exponentially, Kurzweil is the man. And
yes.
And those two books, The Age of Spiritual Machines and then The Singularity is Near. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's there's more ideas in that in The Singularity is Near than you'll find in 10 other books. And yeah, if you don't have a copy of that, drop everything and go get it after the show.
You know, real, if you're going to say something is essential, if you want to understand The Singularity, that's the book you have to read. That is
yeah.
the one that will get you there, I think. That's and so from that standpoint, I would agree with you. However, I went a different way.
Okay.
And although both of the books you named in your naming of two books were very influential, I think there's something about the book that I chose that made all of this that made me a part of it. I can read The Age of Spiritual Machines or The Singularity is Near and be blown away by it, but I read a book called It's Getting Better All the Time, 100 Greatest Trends of the Last 100 Years by Stephen Moore and Julian L. Simon. And this book put me into the middle of a world where things aren't happening the way people say they're happening or the way we've always been led to believe that they're happening. And it's nothing more than a collection of statistics. And it is amazing to read through this book. It's a few years old now, and I hope they'll do a new version of it here in the next few years. But it's basically just a one-page synopsis of a particular area accompanied by a line graph showing how much that area has improved. So I'll just randomly pick a few here. People have more leisure time, entertainment, modern home has every convenience, dental care, getting enough to eat, eradicating killer diseases. And for dozens, let me see actually how many of these categories they list. I think maybe they do 100 of them altogether. Oh, it says 100. That's right, 100 reasons. For 100 different categories, they show how life has actually improved dramatically over the last, in some cases, couple of decades, in some cases, century, in some cases, couple of centuries. And it really opened my eyes to how powerful the things that they call the law of accelerating returns, or that we refer to maybe as the human imperative on the Speculist in our manifesto, how those really are driving the world that we live in, and how different our world is, kind of in the Tom Sawyer vein there, from how it used to be, and how different it works from the way most of us think it works, because there is this huge expectation that things are bad, or this huge understanding that things are bad, and this huge expectation that things are going to get worse. And in fact, when you start looking at the data, you see something completely different. And so I highly recommend that book. It's called It's Getting Better All the Time. And
I can't believe I've not read the book that's the most influential to you, Phil. I've got to go read that immediately.
Well, see, that's why it's important for us to have these conversations,
Steve. Exactly.
We can learn from each other. So what do we got in the chat room there, Michael?
Well, we've got World Religions by Houston Smith, which, at the risk of crediting Harvey with more than one nonfiction, builds on a thread where he was talking about Joseph Campbell and the hero or archetypic hero stuff.
Okay.
And for nonfiction, Age of Spiritual Machines. I'm going to give that one to Matt. I'm not going to read down the rest of his list in the spirit of sticking with one. And although my list of nonfiction was a toss-up, I'll go with the one I read first, because if they really are tied, this one was first in time, and it's The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith.
Aha.
That's interesting. I like that choice. It's a great book. Did they say why that one? Why that particular book?
I choose that from the perspective of how it informs me as a speculist in particular. It's sort of the precursor to Guns, Germs, and Steel, in the sense that it's the first real large, and I hesitate to say comprehensive. I'm sure he was trying to be as comprehensive as he could be, to describe how you organize an economy, how you organize human society. And as an economy, and that the extension of that whether you believe in that or you want to, you know, veer off into other things or whatever. He asked all the pertinent questions, and he sort of defined the field in a way that had never been done.
Right, right.
And in that book, you get the concept of the invisible hand, which with the law of accelerating returns and some of these other ideas we talked about, Mest compression, the human imperative, is one of these great forward-moving I think these are all restatements of some, you know, fundamental principle of improvement. And he captures that very succinctly in that idea of this people acting in their own interest, you know, somehow being guided by this invisible hand, creating the kinds of improvements that you see in a book like It's Getting Better All the Time, or in the mini charts that you see listed in The Singularity Is Near. So there's a real connection between a lot of these different ideas.
Well, I got to mention that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The invisible hand concept came back in Kevin Kelly's book Wired, and he defines it as emergence, or emergent activity, where you know individual entities doing their own thing, a meta behavior emerges, and that emergent behavior is sort of the unexpected result or unpredictable result, but it's powerful and real all the same. And of course, he was talking about the internet and connecting the world, but it's the same idea. It's this idea that as individual actors, in the case of Wealth of Nations, people, or by extension, countries, do what they do, and collectively, something else emerges.
Right.
I have to mention what Matt Doing said here. He mentioned Eliezer Yudowsky's Staring into the Singularity. His book, Staring into the Singularity, left him slack-jawed for about an hour.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, that's a big one, too. Absolutely, very influential reading. And, of course, you can grab that one online, I believe. We can link to that. And I was going to draw it all home by saying, and when we follow the invisible hand or act on the human imperative, maybe we're also following that hero's journey that Joseph Campbell talked about.
Ding.
See, I'm knitting them all together here, making them all work. Okay, where does that get us? What's next?
Website.
Website, okay. Who went first last time? Stephen, I think you did.
I think you went first last, Phil. So
okay, so you're up.
Okay, I'm up. All right. Well, I can't pick the speculist. Although I got to say that when it comes to learning stuff, I mean, going to the speculist, reading not only yours, Phil, but other contributors that contributed to speculist, as well as you can learn from the comments. I mean, we have some sharp readers who leave comments with links and. And so it's a learning experience just to be involved at the speculist.
Absolutely.
But I can't list the speculist. I think that would be a little too self-serving.
So here I go.
Instapundit.
Interesting choice. Okay.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a futurist or singularity-centric site. But Glenn Reynolds is definitely singularity aware, and I like his whole Army of David's philosophy. He's sort of a libertarian. Some people call him a right winger, but he says no. I'm middle of the road, and I agree that he is. He's not really a conservative, and it just comes from being wanting to exercise the power that these as an individual that these technologies allow. And not having the government so much, dictating from on high what it is that we're allowed to do. And so that's, I think that's behind, that's his philosophy. And you could do a lot worse if you want to be kind of a student for life. You could do a lot worse than to, log on every day and read. Just take all his links and just go through them every day. I mean, you learn about everything because the man has extraordinary intellectual curiosity. Everything's interesting to him, and because it's interesting to him, it becomes interesting to you if you read enough. So
absolutely, he takes you to all kinds of places and all across the political spectrum. I mean, he makes his own views clear, but he takes you to places that are not his views at all, which is. I think
it's unusual for a blogger, isn't it? I mean, usually a lot of blogging is an echo chamber kind of thing where you don't get exposed to other ideas. Not at Instapundit. So.
Yeah, he's all over the place. I think that's a great choice. Well, my choice, I went through the list and I scratched my head and I realized that I have to pick the Speculist. And you're right, it sounds very self-serving to choose the Speculist, but it's not because of reading it. It's because of writing it that it's been the most influential for me as a...
You learn by teaching, right? Exactly.
Trying to pursue these ideas, I've had to own them. I've had to look things up. I've had to understand things. I've had to develop my ideas by writing them down. And so I think that in that sense, our blog has been the one that has really pushed me along the farthest. Although that's also a good way of copping out and not picking anybody else's site as the most important one. So I feel like I've saved myself from playing favorites on that one. What do we got on the chat room, Michael?
The chat room, a couple of good mentions here. Yudkowsky.net, which is, I have to say, a mind-twisting experience. It's not the one I selected, but I can see where Matt came up with that one. And also accelerationwatch.org, which I would also agree with is a good one.
That one would have been right near the top of my list, too. And yourself?
Okay, I went a slightly different direction here, and I was thinking about the sort of formative perspective on the web or on the Internet in general, and the first website that really just got me thinking hard about where the web would go and what it would be was Yahoo. And, like everybody else, I think I've morphed over to using Google for most of the search I do, but the first website that just really became a daily part of my life and got me to a point where when I didn't have access to it, it changed the way I functioned was Yahoo. And it forced me to think about, man, what's this? What's going to be? What's coming?
It was a transformative, not event, but presence on the Internet. Everything changed after Yahoo came along and started doing what it did. I think the world has not been the same since then. I think that's a great choice. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're rounding out our discussion of the Speculist Essentials. If you'd like to join us, join the chat in our chat room or give us a call at 347-215-8972.
Okay, I noticed Matt Dewing mentioned Techno Event Horizon, which is a defunct blog that was written by Micah Glasser. I actually tried to lure him over to be a blogger for the Speculist, and I think he... I don't know. He must have burned himself out or something because he. I haven't
the money
seen right.
was not right.
I guess so. You can't do it for the money. That's for sure.
Yeah. We weren't able to match. I think maybe what some others were offering, probably. But that's too bad he's not doing that because that was a great site to follow. Micah's got some really interesting ideas. Okay, we're down to the last two categories, and that gives us event and person. An event. I meant this broadly. It could be any one thing that occurred. Like I just described, Yahoo was sort of an event when it showed up. So the event can be anything. But my event, transformative event, was actually at what's called an event. I was at the Foresight Vision Weekend in 2003, and that was the Foresight Nanotech Institute annual get-together of the senior associates. I had joined, become a senior associate, went to that meeting, and met a lot of the people that I'm in regular touch with now, who we've had as guests on the program, who have influenced my thinking in a lot of ways. I mean, we had Christine Peterson on a couple of weeks ago. She was probably in some ways instrumental in making this event occur. And I'm not talking about the Vision Weekend, but just the fact that I had this kind of eye-opening experience. I knew that there were people interested in these subjects, but I had never been with a group of people who got together and just talked about these things, talked about how nanotechnology was going to impact the world, talked about how artificial intelligence was going to change our world, talked about the singularity. And I really started doing the Speculist in a serious way right after that. So there's sort of a thread here. The Speculist is the big website. I would say that event that really got me serious about doing it was my number one event.
That's interesting. When you said event, I took it in a different way. I took it as a historical event. But if we're talking about events in our own lives, I would say maybe the Rocky Mountain Blogger Convention that time. And in part because that was where we had the germ of the idea for this Fast Forward Radio, and as well as solidified just, you know, I guess my involvement with the Speculist. But as far as historical events, what I went with was Apollo moon landing.
Okay.
And, you know, landing a man on the moon, it's a prime example of engineers as heroes. They took a problem, a huge problem. They worked it step by step until they got a solution. And it's this sort of thing, taking something that looks insurmountable and breaking it up into manageable pieces and working it until until the whole project is a success. Doing something on that large of a scale, it allows me to believe that maybe something like Aubrey de Grey's Sin strategy could work. You know, also look, you know, aging looks like an insurmountable problem, but you divide it up into lesser problems and you just work it. And yep. That's what that's all about. So yeah, I'd have to say Apollo moon landing.
Yeah, the engineer as hero. Yeah, I think that's great. It's the archetype for things happening now and for things to come as well. Michael, what do we got in the chat room?
In the chat, I'll be discreet here, but people referencing life experiences, whether it was a time period in their life when they were very young, or a specific event in their life that I requested video and further detail, none were provided, but I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, we can, you know, having said a specific event, I think we get the gist. Thank you.
There you go.
Those can be transformative.
Specific
too,
first
absolutely.
Time of that event.
Yes.
But I'm going to agree with Stephen that Apollo 11 in July of 69, mostly because it was first in time in terms of events. I could come up with other events, but nothing compares to that. Although I will say that having, as an adult now, looked back on what was going on with Apollo and what was going on with the space program, most of the missions would be equally interesting, but the one that was the focal point was we're going to put people on the moon and we're going to bring them back. It's just huge.
Yep.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that takes us to our final category, the number one person who has most influenced us in shaping our speculist view of the world, shaping our unusual view toward the future. And I believe, Stephen, it's your turn to go first.
Okay. Many possibilities. You know, I mean, Drexler, Kurzweil, Aubrey de Grey. You could go with Richard Feynman. He said in 1959 there's room at the bottom. I guess I'm probably going to have to go with Aubrey de Grey as the person who's had the most influence on me. Number one, because I find his ideas just fascinating. His book is awesome, and I recommend it to anybody. And the whole idea, the audacity of it, is just, you know. And the fact that, you know, we actually could do this. It blows me away. And you talk about something that will change the world if he's even partly right. And we can grant ourselves another decade or two.
If he's even right 100 years from now and it doesn't even apply to us, it's still so huge.
Yeah. It's so huge that, you know, I mean, they'll date history from before and after life extension. That's how big of a deal it is. And so, yeah, I'd have to say Aubrey de Grey, and I have to add to that, he's, you know, we've had personal conversations with him, so for that reason, I mean, he's had a lot of influence on me. So,
good choice. He was on my short list, and since I've been scrupulous about not going through lists as I did this, I now here in the final category, I'm going to mention two names. Okay, I'm going to give my runner-up, and then I'm going to give my actual most influential person. My runner-up would have to be you, Stephen, my co-host, co-blogger, and co-futurist, because having you involved in the Speculist has kept the Speculist going, And having you on Fast Forward Radio has kept me doing this. So just your influence in my life as a speculist has been tremendous, and I want to thank you for that, actually.
Well, I'm very honored. Thank you, Bill.
And my number one person.
Before I get beclimped here, you know.
before we get all beclimped. My number one person is got to be John Smart. I met John at the aforementioned Foresight Vision Weekend in 2003, and one of the first interviews I ever did on The Speculist was with him, and he's just been a tremendous influence in my thinking. He recommended that I read It's Getting Better All the Time. And, of course, Better All the Time, you know, I took that language and made that a regular feature on the Speculist. John's view of accelerating change, messed compression, his idea of what he describes as the ultimate destiny of the human species. Excuse me. We talked about accelerationwatch.org. Anyone who hasn't spent some time on that site, go to that site and read what John has to say. You know, Kurzweil talks about these things. Yudkowsky talks about these things. But John Smart has a spin on the future. He has an outlook on how this is all coming together, and an exhaustive body of knowledge that he draws from in putting together his conclusions that I think just makes him one of the most important people living today, actually. And we're hoping one day that he will agree to be on Fast Forward Radio. He's very busy teaching right now, so we haven't been able to line him up. But I'm hoping if he's listening to this at some point that, John, we'd love to have you on Fast Forward Radio, because you are my number one human influence as a speculist. Okay, Michael, what do we got?
Let's see. In the blog, we have Asimov, which I have to presume is Isaac.
Of course, yeah.
Roddenberry, which I would presume is Gene, and
yeah,
not somebody else. And a mention of Phil, right along with Stephen. So I think you guys are probably both getting your props there.
Well, and you're real good too, Michael. I'm sure somebody meant to mention you too.
No. I didn't build the speculus. I'm just a part of it now, I guess. But here, my choice, and this maybe requires a little bit of context. I grew up in suburban Chicago, and when in the winter of '79-'80, and I think it was actually in the early part of 1980, I went to an event at the downtown campus of Northwestern University, and there was a physicist there from the University of Chicago, Subramanian Chandrasekhar, and he was the first person that I ever heard describe thought experiments and then demonstrate it in a room full of people in a way that maybe it didn't work on everybody, but it worked on me, and I was like, I now feel like I understand the Milky Way. I mean, this guy was a physicist and highly talented, but the magic that day for me was that in having heard people talk about thought experience and having or experiments and having read things where people were like, yeah, I didn't really have a way to experiment with this, but I just thought it through, and here's what I get the idea, but oh my God, my head exploded. I'm like, yeah, okay, we're now out in the middle of the Milky Way picturing Earth, and it just worked for me. So I'm going to name him as the, because it was a personal experience, and it was also first in time for me.
And somebody who really influenced your thinking. That's exactly the kind of people that make a real difference in our lives. All right, well, that sums up, I guess, our discussion of the Speculist Essentials for this time. I think this is a list we're going to have to revisit, and we'll probably be working on over the next few days an expanded version of this list up in the show notes. We'll include maybe some of the runners-up and some links to some of the things we've been talking about.
All right.
So, Stephen, I think we got a couple of things to talk about music-wise tonight.
Yeah, the new Coldplay album is coming out in a couple of weeks, and it has nothing to do really with anything we've been talking about, but I just happen to love Coldplay, and I thought we'd play 30 seconds of the first single that's been released. It's Viva La Vida, which, you know, that ought to be like a alternate a motto for the Speculist.
Viva La Vida means live to see it, pretty much, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. Long live life, I guess, is what it would be pretty much the way that would translate. But it's not exactly an uplifting song, though. But I mean, any rate, it's cool enough. I'm gonna play the first 30 seconds of it.
Okay, let's go. Sounds uplifting at the beginning anyway, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he used to rule the world. Now he's not such a big shot anymore. I think that the song is about King Louis XVI.
Wow.
And not a typical subject for pop music. And you gotta hand it to Coldplay. The reason I love indie music so much is because it's not just the same old that you hear on top 40s, radio, and you could say the same thing about Coldplay. They go a little deeper with their music, and that's one of the reasons I like them so well. Anyway, for our regular music tonight, we've got "Song of the Siren" is the name of the band. The song is "Peace Quiet."
Peace and quiet. Okay, a little follow up to the rather rambunctious program we had tonight. We'll have a little peace and quiet from Siren Song. And Stephen, thank you very much. Great talking with you. Michael, thanks to you and to all our friends in the chat room and to everyone who was listening. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
Ciao.